My name is Jessica Collins. This meeting is being recorded, as we just heard, and I'm the Executive Director of the Public Health Institute of Western Mass. And I'm just so very happy today to have all of you, but really these three tremendous leaders in our region who have been so thoughtfully dealing with COVID-19 from an employer perspective and continuing to provide quality services to folks in our region. So I want to welcome Patricia Samra, RN Vice President of Human Resources Operations and Total Rewards, Roseanne Martosia, Executive Director of West Mass Elder Care, and Les Ben Ezra, Executive Director of the Amherst Survival Center. And so I'll just share a little bit of our plan for the next 60 minutes. I'm going to have each leader describe their organization so that you have the context, and then Patty's going to share some kind of bigger thoughts about COVID-19 and kind of what we've been through here as employers, and then we'll get into some specific questions for each. If you do have questions, please feel free to pepper them in the chat, and we will either call on you to ask yourself, or I can read it out loud. So don't hesitate in commenting in the chat. We love that. And I think we'll begin. So why don't we start, Patty? Well, why don't you just kind of give the context of your organization, then we'll go to Roseanne and then Lev, and then we'll come back to you for the bigger context. So thank you.
That sounds wonderful, Jessica. Thank you all. And thank you for allowing me to pitch hit for my boss, who was unavoidably detained today and couldn't make it. But my name is Patty Samra. I'm the Vice President of Human Resources and Total Rewards, which is really the operations arm of HR for the enterprise of Bay State Health, which has four community hospitals and the main medical center. About 12,500 employees, and then a lot of affiliate physicians. And another sort of component to Bay State is also sort of being the regional educator for clinical, which was a big point of emphasis during COVID, that a role that we had to really evaluate too, that was beyond the services we provide to patients. So I'll stop there.
Okay, great. Thank you. And Roseanne, if you could just share a little bit of the context of your organization, please.
Or thanks for hosting the session and having me join today. West Mass Elder Care is a regional entity. We work with people, younger people and older people, who are mainly at home, and we provide them a long-term services and supports of many, many different kinds. So one of our big challenges was, and we'll talk about this as we go on, but how do we continue to serve people at home during a time when safety, and certainly before vaccine came into play, safety was of the utmost importance. And so we'll talk about that as we go along. Thanks.
Great, thank you. And Lev?
Hey, I'm Lev Ben Ezra. I'm the Executive Director of the Amherst Survival Center. We really operate first and foremost as a community center that is open to anyone and everyone in our community. We primarily serve residents of Hampshire and Franklin County, but on a daily basis see folks from around 40 towns throughout Western Massachusetts. And we, in addition to food and nutrition programs, which are the core of our services and have definitely been the core through our COVID operations, in our full operational mode, we also provide access to free clothing and housewares in our community store. We have a free walk-in medical clinic, a resource center, and a really robust volunteer program, as well as community activities. And so in terms of the scale of the organization, we're on a very different side of the spectrum. We now have 16 employees and about 150 volunteers weekly, which is reduced from between 250 and 260 volunteers weekly prior to COVID.
Wow. I didn't realize you had that many volunteers. That's incredible. So as you can see, we've picked these unique organizations because we think they will have different examples and different pearls of wisdom to share with all of us. So again, thank you to each of you for being here. And Patty, I'll hand it over to you.
Sure thing. Thanks, Jessica. So to just give a broader context with the onset of the pandemic, like many healthcare organizations, we were taking our direction from governing bodies, primarily the CDC, the Massachusetts state government, as well as the Massachusetts Department of Public Health, and really trying to manage a lot of incoming and rapidly evolving direction and advice from those agencies. And like most healthcare organizations, we said this frequently that, it's our first pandemic, so we may not get it right, but immediately stood up a incident command, which was really critical in our success of managing sort of so much communication in a time of high anxiety, not only from the community, but our employee base. That incident command met at least daily, every morning, 7 days a week at 7 a.m., and included representatives from communications, our clinical leaders, epidemiology, as well as human resources, pharmacy, laboratory, and that's just mentioning a few. Supply chain was also a big player in that incident command. And really the premise for incident command was to be able to collaborate and share amongst these leaders of different critical services that we could make timely decisions and also communicate and execute in a very rapid fashion, which is not always an organization's forte, right? You take the time you need to make good decisions, but with the influx of new information and the evolving situation, really needed a mechanism to transform our leadership. So that was a new experience for all of us. And then the other piece that I want to kind of set the stage for that I'm sure most organizations also experience, we had two very different experiences for our 12,000 employee base. Almost immediately in March, we sent home nearly 4,000 employees to work remote, which we never had a plan for. And I would describe it to people, it was almost like the building was on fire and we had people pack their stuff up and go, and that had to be sorted out in parallel on how that infrastructure was going to continue to support the clinical operations now who were on site and having to practice and perform in a very different way than they had been accustomed to. So there was a lot of moving parts and people in unfamiliar roles, responsibilities, or work environments that we had to navigate. I think there were a lot of pearls of wisdom as we've now started to kind of debrief on our experience and things that we would carry forward in terms of from the highest level in our culture around leadership. And probably the thing we talk about most is what was so interesting during this time is how trusting and forgiving we were of each other. Because we were all in had new expectations and had new roles to play in the organization. And we just collaborated so freely, were very supportive when people were trying to stand up new functions and offering support. So it was definitely something that we have reflected on since that time and are like, how do we keep that going in our leadership as we go forward? And just how quickly we were able to implement change. Some of the things that we stood up in literally matters of hours with regard to 24-hour hotlines for employees, mobile testing, I think we stood up in about 72 hours. That took a level of cooperation across the organization that was really unprecedented in terms of getting those necessary services up and running. And the other piece that we talk about from a cultural standpoint is it's one of those times where everyone was clearly aligned with what our mission was. There was a clear understanding and line of sight for every participant to understand our goal was safeguarding our employees, patients, and community, and everything sort of drove those decisions, and that we were going to take all of our direction from sort of the experts in the fields, right? So a lot of constantly collaborating with the CDC and those recommendations, as well as state government. And then lastly, I think too, that we all leaned on some of our professional networks a little bit more than we may have in the past. So a lot of us really connected with our professional networks, where we could share best practices as they were evolving in other organizations. And it was all in the spirit of saving time, right? So if an organization in Boston, and we were talking to chief nurses across New England, actually at that time, and they came up with a solution or even a policy or a practice, they were just sharing it and disseminating those things so everyone could save time and not reinvent the wheel if we had something that was tested. So that's kind of high level how I think our culture has had a really different and rewarding experience through this, and is really looking to carry some of those gems forward as we absorb all this experience into our what'll be our new culture.
Patty, thank you so much. I actually think that was super helpful for you to bring us back to, you know, 12 plus months ago, because now, as we are each trying to figure out kind of the reentry of organizational culture, I think we forget. Sometimes I forget how sort of traumatic that was in the shutting down and the team building. So that's great. Thank you so much.
Yeah, no problem. Yeah. And one thing I did want to just add to that was, as difficult as all that was to stand up, I think we had a sense of relief as things started improving from a public health standpoint. But the unwinding of all this is just as challenging now, to try to go back and say, okay, what does our new normal look like? And what are our expectations for employees? And I think even as individual leaders, I can't tell you how many peers I talk to that say, you know, when we started this, we're very uncomfortable with remote work and how do I lead a team? And now today are like, hey, I think this is actually going pretty well. How far back do we need to go? And do we offer something different for our employee and for our own experiences, not to mention the physical environment that we, you know, have to go back to. So it's all interesting.
Yes. And so that's a perfect lead in. So now what I'm going to do is I'll pose first question, and Lev, maybe you want to go first to answer it, and then we'll go to Roseanne and then back to Patty. So the first question is about, you know, how are you setting up protocols for staff and volunteers? And I guess you could share maybe a little bit of sort of like, so what's the governance, or who's the group maybe deciding these things, and then how does it kind of morph into something that sticks? So Lev, do you want to start?
Sure. So in the very, very small organization that we are, from the governance standpoint, I am the person who is setting those policies and protocols and really serving as the lead communicator of them to staff and volunteer entities. But I absolutely haven't set those or needed to make those decisions by myself in any way. And so very early on, we pulled together a committee of people that included a couple of staff and a board member and a couple of volunteers who had some public health expertise to help wade through the fast and furious guidelines and those pieces as they came in. And then it has really kind of been an iterative process throughout that. What I think is interesting is that in the lead up, in terms of our process of where we're at now, is that in our lead up and in building those protocols, we were pretty consistently a couple weeks ahead of state mandates or guidelines as they came out, which retrospectively was while I think was sort of indicative that we were making some good choices along the way, that then those became broader employer expectations, it also gave us the luxury of time. And I think time in early COVID meant you had 5 minutes, but it was still 5 minutes instead of you were already late and not in compliance with something, to build those processes and roll them out, or to have a start date that was even tomorrow of something that we were doing. And that has been a really interesting, recognizing how quickly we had to make decisions, how relatively little data or information we had, the onslaught of sometimes contradictory guidance or total lack of guidance that we had early on. I think as we look at now, the protocols that we have at this juncture in terms of thinking about how we're responding to vaccines, how we're responding to the world opening up so much more, shifting safety regulations, I think a real guiding principle for me has been that we don't need to do it as quickly as we did last spring, and giving ourselves the time to really be thoughtful about those processes and really be conscientious. Jessica, do you want me to now go into a bit of what those protocols look like and how that's shifting, or was that later?
No, you could share some of your protocols. Sure.
Okay. So as I said at the start, we, with a couple of very specific exceptions, our people, staff, and volunteers have been on site throughout the year. And certainly, I think that's probably true for many of our organizations. After, obviously, the number one goal was safety, and certainly maintaining that trust with people who are coming to the center and our employees and volunteers. And there is this other really core goal for us, particularly how lean we were, and we have scaled up pretty dramatically. But at that point, of this fear and driver around maintaining operational viability, that we really knew that it didn't have to take very many people if there was an on-site exposure of people then needing to quarantine and be home, that would have resulted in us not being operationally viable for a period of time. And so very early on, our goal really became that there would be no on-site exposures. And so that was then the guiding principle in terms of our protocols. And think through, you know, some combination of sheer luck and the protocols in place, that has been our experience. So we've certainly had many positive cases of people who had been on site, but we haven't had those on-site ripple exposures. And so we have had people coming into our building throughout the year. We have some services that couldn't have been moved outside, such as laundry or lockers or mail service for individuals in our community experiencing homelessness. People were still coming inside the building to get food pantry groceries, though we did have a no contact curbside and delivery service as well, so people didn't have to do that. But we moved many services outside, including our meal service and daily fresh produce, so that relatively few clients or participants were coming inside. And that really allowed us to use our full building for the work that staff and volunteers were doing to prepare all of that with solid social distancing in place. So I think that's really the core of that, is really maintaining social distance at every point in the operation. So limits on the number of people in every room, stations in our kitchen, all of those places, and masks. And the only thing that I would say with the specific requirement that we followed with masks is we indicated a set of approved styles. So masks had to be properly fitted, and we didn't allow bandanas or gaiters or vented respirators. And so I took that piece. And we still have, as well as hygiene and self-checks and air filtration and kind of all the other gamut that also unfolded. So at this juncture, we are still in that mode. We have no differentiation with on-site behavior between anyone who's vaccinated or unvaccinated. We still have masks required throughout our property, inside and outside, and social distancing and the other things in place. We do plan to remove the mask requirement outside very soon. but I anticipate keeping the mask requirement inside for quite some time. And again, no differentiation based on vaccinated or not. So did I get, is there anything else you need to add, Jessica? Okay, thanks.
Yeah, that was very thorough. And Roseanne, I'm sure you have similar protocols, but feel free to share your story as well.
Yeah, so I would say that protocols from the beginning have been evolving, and this whole, you know, response through every month has changed depending on what was happening with positivity, exposures, and so forth. So that's been certainly a work in progress. Our protocol, we have about 190 employees. And right at the beginning, we had to sort of determine, you know, what we were in that essential services bucket of organizations and what services were essential, what services could be delivered in a contactless style, and how would we sort of manage our workforce. So we never closed the agency. There's been every day people in the office, if you will, but that was really limited. And because we operate Meals on Wheels, which saw about a 35% increase as many people were home and staying home, people that, you know, wouldn't have used that service previously, but they really felt safer. Though that whole workflow shifted, a lot of outside, even during the winter, different workflows from start to finish and delivering contactlessly. So we asked, you know, consumers to put a table by their door if that was possible. We still saw them. We waited for them to pick up their lunch and went from there. For many of the in-home services, it was really determined by the consumer whether they wanted people in the home. Some people really needed the care, so of course they were gonna accept people coming in. Sometimes families were home because they were working remotely or had come to visit for an extended stay. So that was really dependent on a case-by-case basis. As far as our workforce, you know, I think like the Bay State experience, we had a limited remote work policy. So we had some people that did work at home on a limited basis. We built upon that, both technology-wise and sort of that rapid everyone out of the building, so to speak, and people went home and set up their work there, and many people have been primarily working at home. In the fall, we had people coming back one day a week, and we would have probably accelerated that except for the second surge. So all of that sort of went on pause until mid-January when we resumed that. And now as of, and I'll just say a word about vaccinations, we were also fortunate that our workforce could be vaccinated early on and through community partnerships and sort of these organic networks. We have formal networks statewide, and then there were local networks that really stepped up, and you know, we were able to have our staff voluntarily. We strongly encouraged, we did not require vaccination, but we strongly encouraged it. And so we're probably about at 80% of our staff having been vaccinated. And what we did in June and before that, and let me just say, the first priority was to get back to seeing people at home. So around March, after 2 months, if you know, people are in that 75 plus and 65 plus age range, we encourage staff to get back out and see people on a limited basis, a short visit, you know, to start to see people again. And so that was the first priority. We've opened back up to having two days a week in the office in June, and we'll be open and are open for visitors by appointment. We ask that visitors, you know, wear a mask if they're unvaccinated. It is on that honor system, as we see through the guidance, and we've been following, you know, the same set of guidance, CDC, mass.gov, the Public Health Institute, all along the way. July 12th, we're going to reopen the building. And I think that the other takeaway is that we will be, we're working on right now, we've revised our remote work policy during COVID, and we'll have revised it again in anticipation of allowing, if you will, a hybrid model. Of course, if people prefer to work in the building, that's fine, but probably we'll be going to a 1 to 2 day hybrid model for the positions that that works for. So it's really broadened our scope of that option.
Thank you. That was really comprehensive, as you have really multiple moving parts at your organization. So thank you. Patty?
Sure, I'll just add a few differences and sort of what we've experienced. So having so much change going on, right? So the protocols around mask wearing and things were very different for those that were clinically facing patients and then those who might be on premise, but not in clinical settings. Because supply chain was so stressed, our recommendations changed very, very frequently around who could. At the beginning, we were telling people they could not wear masks unless they were in clinical settings because we were so concerned about days on hand for supplies for staff that were actually caring for COVID patients. So that, with all that rapid change, right, and different expectations, people would hear recommendations perhaps from CDC and then say, well, why am I not wearing a mask in the hospital right now? You know, this could have been like April or March or April or May on the first surge. And we're saying, no, we have to reserve these supplies for direct care staff. And until we can secure enough of the PPE, we really had to walk a fine line around who was able to wear it and receive it and how we used it. Because those protocols and recommendations were literally changing by the day with all those multi-factors, we quickly stood up 4 hotlines for staff. We sent out a daily briefing. It was probably the most well-read communication we've ever had. People waited for this COVID briefing every day to see like, okay, where are we at? What's the next recommendation? But in addition to that, we set up 4 hotlines. One was around HR policies. We had policies changing around leave of absence, pay, furlough, if I was symptomatic. So employees could call 24/7 and get an answer around how their situation would be managed through these amended HR policies. The second hotline was dedicated to clinical protocols. So as recommendations change from the CDC, clinicians could call up and say, hey, somebody refresh me. I want to understand, how do I use this piece of equipment appropriately, or what's the PPE required for this patient type? So they always had somebody that they could immediately pick up a phone and get an answer. The third and probably the most utilized hotline was the employee health hotline. So this was a hotline that would see anywhere from 100 to, in our peak, 600 calls a day, with employees who were trying to navigate if they were exposed, symptomatic, how do they get tested, should they get tested, and just lots of fear and anxiety there. That situation evolved into being we spun off a 4th hotline after that. As people's anxieties were high, we were clearly seeing an uptick in behavioral health issues with our employee base, and had a 4th hotline for people to access EAP and other services immediately and knew they could call somebody. Like the other organizations on the panel today, we had to make those decisions of who was essential to be on site and who we would say, no, you couldn't come on. We immediately suspended clinical education, our volunteer programs, and really tried to reduce the amount of people we had on the physical plant in order to maintain clinical operations. Probably the hardest thing for us culturally is going into the pandemic. We certainly had a culture of what we were calling presenteeism, right? I have a head cold, but you know, I'm good enough to work. I'll come to work. And then you were immediately flipping trying to flip the culture to say, no, we don't want you here if you're not well, if you have a fever, if you have the sniffles. So that's where the employee symptomatic hotline was just inundated, because people felt an obligation to be there clinically, but you're trying to limit the exposures, and you're balancing that, you know, what if I have an exposure and we have 30 staff members exposed and we have to close the unit. So that was probably the hardest cultural shift to drive home with employees, to say, like, if you're not well, please do not come to work. And they'd call and they would want you to tell them it was okay to go to work. And you know, these calls would go on of like, you called because you're concerned, but we really want you to stay home. And that's where the testing came in to be like, we had to turn our employee testing around as quickly as humanly possible, where we could get people back into the workforce who were, you know, definitely suffering from allergies and it wasn't COVID. But that was probably the trickiest cultural shift we were battling throughout the pandemic. And the other piece is that's really tested us is how we communicate with employees, right? You know, like a lot of organizations, email is a huge communication vehicle. But at the time, some of our most essential workers, which are food, nutrition, environmental service workers, are not on computers all day, are not you know, reading email briefings and things like that. So that's where the hotlines were really beneficial for that staff to just be able to call and get someone to answer their questions if they had concerns. So those were some of the big changes.
Patty, do you see those hotlines continuing now? What are you bringing forward?
So the two that are still in operation are the COVID symptomatic hotline. A lot of that has shifted into vaccine questions. Can I get a vaccine? When can I get a vaccine? Now we're trying to address, we're probably around the 80% mark as well in terms of vaccinated workforce. And we kind of divide the remaining 20 into two groups, the reluctant and the resistant. And we're really trying to focus on those that are reluctant, who really want to talk to someone. And, you know, we had a lot of employees in that reluctant group who were like, I don't want to get it first, but don't take me off the list. I want to get it later. Right. So we kind of keep managing that situation. And unfortunately, we still have, employees coming down with COVID who were not vaccinated, but we do have some that are coming down with COVID who have been vaccinated. So you have that 5% of employee of vaccinated people that will still come down with COVID, much less severe, but again, trying to pull them out of the workforce, manage their time away, manage their return to work. And then the behavioral health hotline has been very instrumental. There's just a tremendous amount of stress and anxiety and fear that is still out in the community for a multitude of reasons of, you know, how we've changed and practiced and interacted for a year. And now there's anxiety about returning to work and do I have to, and, you know, all these sorts of questions. So really trying to get people to behavioral health support as quickly as possible.
Okay. And I feel like that's sort of a perfect lead to the next question, which is sort of, all right, how are you building current, how are we each building current culture, if you will. So I'm curious, how are each of you handling the, are you vaccinated? And, you know, for those of you that have volunteers, how are you welcoming in clients and guests? I know, Roseanne, you said about the honor code, but I'd like to hear a little bit more. How are you each handling that? And Lev, we can go back to you.
Great. So we are not asking volunteers or guests about vaccination status, though certainly lots of people are volunteering that information. I think particularly in terms of, as I had mentioned, with some services outside, that's where we're seeing a few hundred people, guests every day coming through, with relatively very few, maybe 50 people actually coming into the building. So we have just adopted universal precautions. And then, as I mentioned, those certainly are shifting now at this point, given communities, lower community spread and increased vaccination rates, but have just determined that it just felt, did not feel practical on our end to enforce, to ask, and how to do that. And so have adopted that standpoint of just a universal precaution that we're doing there. We're of course following the differentiated guidelines in terms of protocol post-travel and post-exposure and those kinds of things based on someone's vaccination status for both staff or for volunteers. So that's how we're handling that. And I spoke a little bit before, so I don't need to go in further in terms of those ongoing protocols, but I do think just to speak to what Patty was sharing of this on the culture standpoint of this reluctance and anxiety as people are coming back, I think that's been a really interesting. We are continuing to hear from, particularly from volunteers or from guests that are coming for lunch, people who are upset about still needing to, you know, stand in a distance line or still needing to wear a mask or those kinds of protocols. And we are also hearing from people saying, thank you so much. And I don't feel comfortable going to the grocery store now because now people are not wearing masks. And someone who I spoke to recently who said, I'm immune compromised. And my doctor has said, I still need to act as though I'm unvaccinated, even though I am vaccinated, because they don't know how well it's going to work. And now we're seeing this rise, particularly locally, of these Delta strand cases, which seem to be transmitting more through the vaccine, though people aren't getting severely ill. So I think that has been a tension that, while there are certainly folks that are very vocal that we should, you know, just no longer have any of these precautions in place, there are also folks who are sometimes a little bit less vocal or really letting us know that in accessing their basic needs, like throughout the community at large, they're feeling like their safety is less secure and are trying to navigate that. So I think as we continue, as all of these organizations are continuing to provide for these really basic services, it's trying to balance that. We know people need healthcare. We know people need access to Meals on Wheels or the supports that they're getting. We know people need access to food. And so how do we continue to manage that in a way that's safe for folks, whether they have kids who are unvaccinated, whether they have chosen to not get vaccinated yet because they don't feel safe, whether they have other health risks, et cetera. So it's certainly that tug that we're in right now.
Roseanne, do you
want to? Sure. And before I talk about the are you vaccinated question, I would just say that PPE has become an ongoing part of our supplies. And, you know, for our consumers at home and for our staff, since PPE was readily available, so last spring, we have daily requests that are filled by one person and either sent out by mail or left at someone's desk, if you will. So that encouraging the use of PPE, whatever we have a great supply, especially for consumers at home who are receiving care. Their direct workers are still required to wear masks. So I think there's a lot of need for assurance that I have enough at home. And so we're continuing to fill those orders. It's probably 5 to 10 a day. So we're probably up into the, 1,500 requests that have been filled. So with that, it's become part of our culture. And I think without judgment right now, right? So if someone is comfortable not wearing a mask, we're starting to have a little bit of in-person meetings. Usually that's a smaller, someone will enter my office or we'll sit in a room together. And if we're both comfortable to say, are you vaccinated? Okay, fine. No mask, that's okay. But we've also educated our staff and have put out, FAQs so that those situations where we don't know everyone's personal situation, they may have young people at home, they may have children, they may have someone they're caring for. So if someone opts to wear a mask, that's fine as well. So really to have personal choice guide and have that be the case. As far as visiting people at home, we expected, I think, a little more question about, are you vaccinated before you come to my home? And if that's the case and that question is posed, if the person is comfortable saying, yes, I've been vaccinated. And really with older people, I think you see it in the vaccination rates. They were very anxious to be vaccinated. Most people are vaccinated. And so they're like, I'm vaccinated. If you're vaccinated, come on over. They're happy. You know, they're just welcoming that contact after such a long period of social isolation. We see a little bit more hesitancy in the work that we do with younger people. And sometimes that may be because they are, you know, they have their own complicated medical situations or reluctance for some other reason. So we're really continuing to do education, have sent out education with every, you know, delivery of PPE, having that be culturally and in language that, you know, in Spanish, so translated, working with the community health center to make sure that the information that we're giving is clinically, you know, appropriate and in a language, you know, just a level of literacy that works for everyone. So really working on those things and continual staff education. So I would say that, you know, it's really, and if someone is not comfortable, we offer them the opportunity to say, this is a personal medical decision. And let it go at that. So, you know, so far it hasn't been a big widespread issue, but I think it's one that we'll just continue to have to navigate as the situation continues. And as there still are infections, we still have to remain careful and vigilant. So some of the things that we've had, you know, in the office and those protocols will just continue in terms of disinfecting and, you know, all the practices that I think we've adopted on a longer term basis through this learning experience.
Thank you. And Patty, I'm curious how you're going to respond, but also could you maybe talk to all of us about what you see as a required vaccine potentially in the future or not?
Sure. Well, I'll start with right now in terms of masking protocol. Masking in any clinical setting is required. In non-clinical setting, it is strongly encouraged for those employees who are not vaccinated for their own protection. So that's really how we've been communicating that. Although if you're not necessarily essential to be on campus, we have not returned many people back to campus yet. I know for the corporate office, we are, I've probably gone in two or three times evaluating space, determining how we will return to that campus. But that right now the vaccine status is voluntary on whether you want to disclose it or not and share it with anyone. It's private medical information, but that we do encourage people to mask, particularly those that have chosen not to be vaccinated. For their own protection. So we're really trying to reinforce with staff that this is about their individual protection, but we're not mandating the masks. And I do want to say it's a rapidly evolving situation. And really where we're trying to balance as an organization is the stability of our overall workforce, right? So the clinical workforce is very depleted in terms of, you know, we have the vacancy rates we've never seen before. So we are constantly battling having enough staff. So you're trying to walk that fine line of protection without crossing over into a mandate. And we had our first experience with mandating a flu vaccine this year. We've always encouraged it. And the alternative to being flu vaccinated was if you chose not to, you had to wear a mask. Well, going into this season, it was like, well, everybody's got to wear a mask anyway. Are we going to see a big downturn in flu compliance and now be battling flu outbreak? And is it COVID outbreak? So that's really what led to the decision to go to a flu mandate this year. And that was tricky to be, you know, it was a lot of navigating both religious accommodations and personal health, you know, complexities. And we got there. But right now we're handling the idea of a mandated COVID vaccine by saying until it is FDA approved, we're not considering a mandatory vaccine. So we're really trying to buy ourselves some time with that. It's not as big a risk for our workforce because we are probably 2 times where the community is in terms of vaccines. And we are growing in that number every day organically by the people leaving the workforce are probably those who are not interested in being vaccinated. And as we bring people into healthcare, they're kind of or into our organization, they're coming in sort of realizing I'm going to need to get a vaccine upon entry. So it's moving on its own, but we are very cautious about how we talk about mandate so that we don't inadvertently either influence the stability of the workforce at this particular time. So we're trying to share exactly where we are as an organization in that decision without overstating where we will land on that.
Okay, so just to clarify then, none of you in your organizations have are you vaccinated ask question is what I'm hearing, that you're doing this kind of honor code. And hopefully if people are not vaccinated, they are wearing a mask if they're coming into your site. Is that what I'm hearing from all three?
Yes.
Yes.
With the exception of pre-employment. So like any immunization pre-employment, they would have to disclose whether they're vaccinated or not and produce evidence of that. Yeah.
Okay. Oh, that's interesting. Okay. All right. So we've got a question here from Casey Kroon. What do you tell people who have concerns about the long-term safety of the mRNA vaccines? So I guess that's a great question. And I'm also curious, are you as leaders, do you feel like troubleshooting answers to employee or volunteer or client questions?
I would say that if a specific question that as specific as this question came up, we would refer the staff member to speak with their PCP about, you know, long-term safety, to seek that education from a clinician, because we're really not in that position to offer advice or any recommendations about that.
What about, Patty, go ahead.
No, I was just gonna say, you know, we have the luxury of actually having an infectious disease team and physicians that are credentialed in vaccines. So we again, you know, from an HR perspective and even individual leader perspective, we tried to have those expert clinicians having those conversations and referring people to their PCP in terms of what's their unique health situation and what do they want to take into consideration. We have done a lot of outreach with people talking about, we've held a couple of open forums for employees to call in and ask questions directly of clinicians around these things. So we're trying to rely on the experts, make it part of a open dialogue, if you will, but really not a leader expectation in terms of talking to your staff about those things.
Yeah, similarly, we have disseminated, our role has really been disseminating similar information that we're trying to make very available to our community members, participants, clients, also to our volunteers and staff in terms of information. And so we've gotten benefited from some great information put out by the Public Health Institute, by Bay State, by Cooley Dickinson, some other great entities. And so have really tried to just basically be educating our staff and volunteers right along with our broader community. But it's an interesting, tricky role of just making sure that we're playing that entity. We know that we're a trusted body for many of the folks that are coming. And so it's a powerful outreach opportunity, but also being really clear that we can't provide individualized medical guidance. And so are just providing that general information and helping people try to wade through a lot of really complex information in different ways that's accessible, simple, certainly multiple languages, kind of addressing concerns that are coming, showing up differently among different cultural groups that are coming to the center. So it's just been trying to connect folks with that information that's been produced elsewhere. But certainly not my area of expertise.
Okay. Thank you, Casey, for that question. So we're kind of coming towards the end here, but our final questions are about, you know, what you see for the fall, you know, or what you're anticipating figuring out throughout the summer into the fall. And also, how do you as leaders stay up with the latest, you know, guidelines and regulations for your particular industry or type of organization? Roseanne, you want to go first?
Sure. You know, I think CDC has been, you know, our friend in terms of bulletins and read. I think the mass.gov, both the VAC site and the dashboard. The dashboard is daily reading for me just to sort of keep my pulse on what's happening. The weekly Public Health Institute newsletter that breaks it, or e-news that breaks it down by county, has been great. And then I think Patty mentioned our professional networks. You know, I think there's been amped up calls, you know, weekly calls where maybe those would be monthly calls. Our HR leadership has calls with their counterparts, education that we can get from all sources. And, you know, local coalitions, I would say, would be another source. And then, you know, informal conversations and learning like we're doing today, and sharing best practices with our colleagues. I think those are some of the main ways we've been keeping up with the constantly changing news, as well as, you know, our funding streams have given us our contracts, different program flexibilities, and now we're starting to see those unwind. So it's what are we doing today? How do we document it? What, you know, how do we remain compliant and work with people over time?
That's great. Lev, do you want to add to that?
Yeah, I think I echo all of the different sources of information that Roseanne shared. And I'll just add, I don't know if I'm supposed to admit this in public, right? There's also that element of where does information come from, is that somebody knocks on my office door and says, "So Baker said this, does that mean we're doing that?" And I say, "What a great question." You know, that I frantically Google, right? So I think that that has also been, frankly, you know, different people having questions about how something that they heard on the radio is impacting them has actually been a really valuable source of various information. So I think I've probably reduced the several times a day checking various sources of information to pretty much, I have a bunch of those resources that Roseanne mentioned bookmarked, and I look at them on Fridays and then mull over if we have to do anything different the next week. The only other piece, though, that I did want to say, I think I actually got this from a Public Health Institute bulletin that was sent out, was recognizing the role of the different guidelines. And it really helped me to think differently about them and how they were shaping what our protocols were, of the CDC guidelines really for individuals as really information that helps individuals to make their own choices or their own family choices based on their own situation, their own needs, their own risk factors, their own risk tolerance. And then there's this separate set of guidelines, the CDC guidelines for employers, which really dictates employer responsibility for a group of people that have a diversity of risk profiles and situations. And then the Massachusetts guidelines really balancing public health and reopening the economy and political forces at play. And I think thinking about the roles of all of those three has been helpful for me in weighing where do we then fall in the midst of all of it, but also explaining to, whether it's the public, to our volunteers, to our staff, in the instances where something that we're doing is different from particularly the CDC guidelines for individuals, which is the one that folks are most commonly aware of now. So that's been helpful. I was really appreciative. I'm pretty sure, Jessica, that it came from Public Health Institute. And that was really helpful.
That's great. Thanks for both the shout out and the clarification of how you're feeling. And Patty, in the last couple of minutes, do you have anything to add? I know you've got all those infectious disease experts around you. But
exactly. Yeah, so they really help us. I mean, I think, you know, when we talk about what does the summer and fall hold, you know, I think it will be where do we settle as an organization as it relates to remote work or some sort of hybrid. And I think as individuals, everybody was kind of quick to say, I'm comfortable remote, but we do have a fair segment of our workforce who is anxious to get back to some social interaction. So we're trying to balance how do we reconfigure our physical plant? And that's actually consuming up quite a bit of time in saying like, okay, before we move everybody out, how much space do we reserve for people who want to come in? And are people's feelings going to change as we go on? So that I think will consume us some of this unwinding of all these things we've put in place. And even from the clinical operations, they still have a lot of unwinding to do with regard to patient placement, where teams have moved. And, you know, we're just trying to get back. We call it the pre-pandemic state. Like, how close can we get back to operations that reflect that pre-pandemic state? So that'll take some time. And then the last point will be on the whole vaccine question around if we mandate, is there a booster required, you know? And then we'll come into the fall where we'll be back in flu season again and be battling with the idea of presenteeism versus absenteeism again. So I think those are where we'll spend the vast majority of our time in the coming months.
So well said. Thank you all. We've come to our time and I just want to say thank you. I have learned a ton in the past 60 minutes and I just appreciate your leadership and your just fantastic ability to articulate this complex situation as humans, but as leaders and as, you know, employers in our region. So thank you so much to those of you that joined us. We appreciate your time. Please take a minute to tell us about this webinar experience. And if you have need information, we send our e-newsletters out and there's always our website and our dashboard. So thank you, Roseanne and Lev and Patty. Thank you so much and take care.
Thank you for the opportunity.
It was a pleasure. Good to see everyone.